This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Bob Mann, LSU professor of mass communication and former top aide to Kathleen Blanco, John Breaux, Russell Long, Bennett Johnston. He's here to talk some politics. 4 weeks away from the election, the U.S. Senate race is simmering with Mary Landrieu and Bill Cassidy and Rob Manus out on the hustings. We'll talk with Bob Mann about that. And also, Bob, surprisingly, has written a column charitable toward a prominent Republican in the state, David Bruce Vitter. What's going on? And Alan Salkin. His book is The Uncensored History of the Food Network. In 1993, it started almost unnoticed. Today, 100 million homes have the Food Network. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing, and our guest is Bob Mann, the Manship School of Mass Communication professor, a man who has been around the political block many times, and now we're rounding the corner toward home as the 2014 election is now 4 weeks away. Recent polls have shown Bill Cassidy with a slight lead over Mary Landrieu. How do you see it 4 weeks out?
Well, it's very close, but I think the political winds are blowing pretty hard in Cassidy's favor. This is a state that President Obama is very unpopular in, and this is a tough environment for an incumbent Democrat to be running in anywhere in the country, really, but especially in a state like Louisiana, where the president's popularity is so low.
Mm-hmm. Are you still a Democrat, Bob?
I'm not a Democrat. No, no. I switched parties.
You're
well. I didn't switch parties. I became no party. So I'm not. I'm just an independent now.
So you have disavowed any knowledge of the Democratic Party. What happens to the Democratic Party if Mary Landrieu loses?
Well, I don't think that anything happens to the. When I talk about the Democratic Party to people, I always try to say it's important to separate the elected officials who are members of the Democratic Party from the party apparatus itself, because I think those are two different animals and operating in almost two different orbits in a way. I don't think that I think it's a symptom of the if Mary Landrieu loses, a symptom of the failure or the collapse of the Democratic Party in the state. But I don't think is the reason the party is collapsing. I think there are different forces at play here. I think the party itself has badly mismanaged its operations, and I don't think the party is you know, leading in the way that it should if they want to revive themselves and restore their former glory. But I think that's different from why Mary Landrieu might lose.
Well, Bill Cassidy was a Democrat until he was about 45 years old, and then he decided he wanted to be in politics, and he made what strategically may have been a brilliant decision. He decided to become a Republican.
Yeah.
If Mary Landrieu loses, there will be no statewide Democrats remaining.
Right.
Zero.
Right.
Some young person who's thinking about politics, who really doesn't have any strong allegiance to one party or the other and has to join one to be effective, it would seem that almost by default, it'll be the way it used to be. People will become Republicans by default.
Yeah, and I think you're already seeing that, and that the division in the state is not so much between Democrats and Republicans, at least on the statewide level. In the legislature, it still is to a degree, but on the statewide level, it's becoming a division between moderate Republicans and moderate and conservative Republicans. That was the division that happened when Jay Darden, our lieutenant governor, beat Billy Nungesser in the race. All the Democrats got the message that Darden was the more moderate Republican and voted for him, and he won the race. And so, and I think you'll see that possibly in next year's governor's race as well. If you see a runoff between two Republicans, one's going to strike the more moderate pose and go for those Democratic votes.
297-5633 is your number. Bob Mann is the guest, who is now an erstwhile Democrat, a no-party pundit who works at the Manship School of Mass Communication. And of course, he writes for NOLA.com. What about Edwin Edwards? He has been endorsed by the Democratic Party for the 6th District. Do you find that palatable?
Well, and that's the reason why I left the party, because I didn't want to be I think that was sort of the, in many ways, the last breath, the dying gasp of a party apparatus. Party leadership. I'm talking about the Democratic State Central Committee. That's really looking backwards in a way. I mean, they're trying to relive their glory days of Edwin Edwards. I don't particularly see what was so glorious about those days, but to a lot of Democrats in the state, those are glory days. And a party that's looking backwards to Edwin Edwards is not a party that's going to any time reassert itself on the statewide stage. It's not the reason why the party has collapsed. I mean, Edwin Edwards is not the reason why there's no Democratic elected officials other than Mary Landrieu in this state. Mm-hmm. But I think it's symptomatic of the party's nostalgia for a past that is never coming back. And if the Democrats want to rebuild this party, they've got to have a serious talk among themselves and figure out what they need to do to reassert themselves. And it isn't embracing Edwin Edwards. That's I know that for sure.
But Edwin Edwards gave us John Brough.
Well, yeah, and you know, that's true, but I don't think that anyone who knew John Brough ever thought that John Brough and Edwin Edwards were particularly close, were particularly even of the same style. Edwin Edwards was, you know, his whole tenure was tainted by unethical and corrupt dealing in office, and I don't think that anyone ever accused John Brough of that. I worked for John Brough for 17 years, and I can count on one hand the time that I ever saw them together or heard them talking, and Senator Brough certainly didn't consult Edwin Edwards on, you know, his political strategy. So, they started out, as did Billy Tozan as mm-hmm. well, and they parted company as well. So
he had an eye for talent.
Well, yeah, but I think that to compare the two of them is... You know, he worked for John. John worked for
Edwin. And succeeded him in Congress.
But, you know, I don't think they were
with
ever... With
Edwin's
support, right, mm-hmm. right.
So why isn't John Brough down here campaigning for Edwin Washington?
Well, you'd have to... I haven't spoken to Senator Brough about that, so I don't know. But again, I say that I don't know that... You know, I don't honestly know how often they talk, but I know that when I worked for John Brough... I could count on one hand the number of times that I saw them together, heard them talking. In fact, the closest that I ever saw them work together was when Edwin was running against David Duke in that governor's race in 1991, and Senator Brough and every other Democrat and Republican was trying to help
Edwin. Buddy Romer.
Yeah, right.
Who, of course, had lost.
Exactly.
But John Brough, I'm reading an email from a listener, has not been on the trail for Mary Landrieu either. What's going on there?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. And I just don't know. I haven't spoken to Senator Brough for a couple of months. We traded text messages a couple of weeks ago when his partner, Tommy Boggs, died. But I haven't had a conversation with him. So I don't know. You may see him in the end. I think a lot of people are waiting on the sidelines for this runoff. I mean, you know, this what we're going to see in November is not the determinative thing. I mean, I think everybody knows there's going to be a runoff between Cassidy and Landrieu, and the real race is going to come in November. So that may be the more opportune time.
December.
I'm sorry. Yeah. The runoff period will be in November. The real campaign is going to start in November.
So December 6th could be the day.
Yeah.
But Landrieu, I think, has to run first in the primary. She can't run second with Rob Maness getting to 10%, let's say, and then that 10's almost certainly going to be most of it to Cassidy.
Right.
So she has to run first, and she probably has to run first by at least 5 points to be a viable contender to retain her seat. Right now, 4 weeks before the election, how do you see it?
Well, I think that Cassie's got the advantage. I mean, I think it's just... I like Mary Landrieu. I consider her a personal friend. Her husband is a dear friend of mine, and I'm very favorably disposed toward Mary Landrieu. I plan to vote for her, but it would be foolish of anyone to say that Mary Landrieu is not in deep trouble, and it doesn't have as much to do with Mary Landrieu. In fact, I think you could argue that the reason she's still in this race, Charlie Cook, by the way, has got a column out today saying, you know, she's still very much in this race, and one of the reasons she's in this race is because she's a very good politician, a very good candidate, has been a very good senator. But this is an increasingly Republican state in which Barack Obama is very unpopular, and she's an incumbent, and the referendum, it tends to be a referendum on the incumbent and on the incumbent's party, mm-hmm. represented by Barack Obama. So it's a really tough environment for her. And I would say if she wins this race, it will be because Cassidy stumbles badly in a debate, and that which is very possible, which is why Cassidy does not want to debate and why his advisors are discouraging him from debating more than twice.
Yeah, he's dodging her, and I would imagine that in December there will be more calls, and this time a head-up debate between the two. I saw Jimmy Carter. He didn't want to debate Ted Kennedy.
Yeah,
but usually it's the incumbent who is. John Breaux didn't want to debate anybody in '92 or '98, and he didn't debate Jim Donnelly.
He didn't debate, and there was not really much pressure for him to debate because, for one thing, I don't think people saw it really as a competitive race. This is a competitive race, and Cassidy. The reason Landrieu is pushing Cassidy to debate is because I think it's sort of understood that Cassidy is the front runner in this race, and Landrieu is needs to take him down, and the way to do that is expose him to an unstructured environment, which he stayed mm-hmm. out of largely, get him in a debate, and hopefully he makes a gaffe or says something that hurts him.
The Landrieu press operation is putting out all kinds of releases about Cassidy being, quote, cowardly. That's the word used. Not manning up. They're trying to entice him into a debate.
Yeah. Well, that's probably not going to work, but I guess that's what you do. But I don't think that it's cowardly necessarily. I think it's just a recognition that Cassidy is probably not a strong debater. And
don't the people of Louisiana deserve a debate? Didn't they deserve one when John Breaux ran against Jim Donnelly?
Look, I'm not saying they don't, and I think my school is putting on one of the two debates, so I'm very happy that they're debating, and I think there ought to be more debates. But I'm talking from very, very cold, calculating political standpoint. In each campaign, Landrieu wants Cassidy in those debates to expose him more, basically what he's doing is he's able to communicate with the voters through these 30-second spots, and she needs him in an unrehearsed environment where he might make a mistake. Now, he might not. That's the other thing. I mean, he may come after her and attack her in a way that hurts her. So it's not entirely without risk to Mary Landrieu. Let's be clear about that.
But debates can make a difference, and they can make a difference late in the campaign. Look at Reagan and Carter in 1980.
Yep.
That won the election for
that's
Ronald
right.
Reagan.
That's right. Now, not a lot of people are going to watch these debates, and most people who watch the debates have already made up their minds, but the press coverage has a tremendous impact if someone makes a mistake.
Yeah. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Bob.
Yes. Do you think that John Breaux now has a greater affinity for his partner, Trent Lott, and making money as a lobbyist than anything that might be good for Louisiana?
Well, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, in a sense, he and Trent have always been very good friends. They were next-door neighbors. He's godfather to Lott's children and vice versa. There's a very close mm-hmm. personal friendship there that goes back 30 or more years, and they're now in practice together. I think that, honestly, I don't believe that the voters of Louisiana really, in all deference to my boss or any other Bennett Johnston or any other former member of Congress, I don't think the voters of Louisiana need John Breaux or Bennett Johnston or Bob Livingston or anybody else to tell them who to vote for in this race. They're perfectly capable of making their minds.
But to cash in on the connections they made as members of Congress put there by the state of Louisiana.
Oh, there's the question whether they should be a lobbyist or not.
Yeah, Bob Livingston's another one.
Yeah,
it's shameful.
Well, it's shameful if they're doing it illegally or unethically, but I don't know that the very idea of being a lobbyist is not necessarily
a member of Congress, I think you cash in your chips. You don't become a lobbyist.
Well, then we need to pass a law that says
we
that.
Well, we do, but
because right now
members of Congress
have
would have to do
law.
That,
yeah,
and they're not going to.
Well, I don't think that. Look, I don't. So, I think the question is how do you do your lobbying? I mean, I think that there are plenty of lobbyists down there at the Capitol who do a great job who aren't buying votes, and some probably do, and that's to me is what makes lobbying troublesome.
I like what Charlie Melanson did. He was a member of federal Congress and came back home to lobby. We'll talk more with Bob Mann after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Bob Mann, former press secretary to Kathleen Blanco, Bennett Johnston, John Breaux, Russell Long, all prominent Democrats. Now Bob is a no-party manship mass communication professor, and he has served his state well in this capacity, and he writes a column at NOLA.com, and he has been on Bobby Jindal's one-yard line for some time.
I think I've scored a few touchdowns, actually, Jim.
Well, today the Advocate wrote a piece praising the governor for economic development. Do you give him credit there?
Yes and no. I think that I think he's done a pretty good job of recruiting businesses to the state. I do have a problem with paying corporations to come here. I think that arms race of that these states are engaged in is kind of unseemly, and I wish we didn't have to do that. But I give him credit. But I also think that the revival of the oil industry is a big part of it, and I'm not sure Jindal had much to do with that. But he's governor, and he deserves to take credit for the good as well as take blame for the bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's running for president. By the way, I was out in California last week, and I read once again that Jerry Brown flies Southwest Airlines, uses his senior citizen discount with no bodyguards. He's 76 years old. He's governor of a state that has the seventh largest economy in the world. Why does Bobby Jindal need an entourage when he goes to Iowa and New Hampshire?
I don't know. And I work for a governor who had a pretty large, had state police around her, and I think the state police have the responsibility to protect the governor. I don't have a problem with one or two troopers. I think that's very appropriate. I don't know how many troopers travel with Jindal. But
it's a taxpayer expense.
Yeah, it's a taxpayer expense, and that's fine. I think that when the governor is traveling for official business, that is fine. I think that if you're not, then there may be a better arrangement where the campaign pays for some of that, but he's always the governor. It's just like the president when he travels, and he's doing campaign events. He still is entitled to personal security, and no one begrudges the Secret Service protecting him. No one says they should stand down during a campaign rally, so I don't have a problem with that. The only question I have is how many troopers does the governor really need? I work for two U.S. senators for over 20 mm-hmm. years, never a single bodyguard or a security person around them, and never in that time did I perceive or observe a threat to them personally.
And that is interesting. And they were well-known people.
Yeah, we've in the whole history of the Republic, we've had two U.S. senators assassinated, Huey Long and Robert Kennedy. We've had Gabby Giffords, but we haven't had many members. Members of Congress travel around the country without security, mm-hmm. and we don't hear of people attacking them for the most part.
Well, Les Miles has a veritable army around him. Maybe he needs one now, but football coaches and the security that they recorded started with Bear Bryant, and that's a waste of taxpayer money. Here they are around 100 well-conditioned athletes in a stadium that has police protection to begin with, and they need state police around them.
That's kind of silly. That's kind of silly. Okay. Yeah.
Bob Mann writes in his latest column, "What's the difference between former Governor Edwin Edwards and U.S. Senator David Vitter? Vitter paid prostitutes and apologized, while an unabashed Edwards has often bragged about his sexual prowess. Vitter has always campaigned against public corruption, while Edwards used his high position to enrich himself and his friends. Vitter is a committed conservative. Edward remains of an old-styled populist. They are about as different as two politicians could be. In my mind, however," Bob writes, "here's the crucial difference. For his crimes, Edwards deserves to lose his race for the state's 6th congressional district seat. Despite his 2007 prostitution scandal, the voters were probably correct in re-electing Vitter in 2010. Surprising words from you.
Well, I'm not saying that I voted for Vitter or I will ever vote for him, and I'm not saying that I agree with I think that the voters elected the right person, the right guy. I'm saying that Vitter represents the growing conservatism of this state, and the voters are entitled to have someone who represents their views in Washington, and Vitter did that and does that pretty well. If you're a conservative, you know, there's not, you don't find much to argue with about David Vitter and his ideology. So, you know, I don't think he's an illegitimate leader in any way. I think that he ran a good campaign. He certainly ran a better campaign than his opponent, and he won that election fair and square. And more importantly for him, he put away, I think, decisively any questions about his personal life. He answered the question, do the voters care more about my ideology than my personal life? And they said resoundingly, we want a conservative, and we don't really care about what you do in your private life, which I think is entirely appropriate. And in the column, I made the point that the Democrats who have a problem with Vitter were pretty quick to forgive Bill Clinton of having sex with an intern and lying to a grand jury. They were pretty quick to forgive Clinton of that. They should have this. They should have the same charity toward Vitter.
Well, Clinton was never convicted of perjury.
He lost his law license for it, though.
He lost his law license, and he was impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives. Vitter, on the other hand, has admitted, more or less, to committing a crime. He was an unindicted co-conspirator in the D.C. Madam case, and she committed suicide before she went to trial. But he was an unindicted co-conspirator. Why was he given a pass on a crime against the United States of America?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but the way I understand it is, and let me say very clearly, I don't condone what David Vitter did. I don't condone it at all. I condemn it. I think it was sleazy and beneath the dignity of a member of Congress, which I wrote in the column. But my understanding as a non-lawyer is that, number one, the statute of limitations had expired. And number two, by the time that he admitted this, he was out of the House, which is where the crimes occurred, and there was no jurisdiction. The House wasn't going to investigate a former member. The case died. Look, again, I'm not saying that Vitter did the right thing. I'm not excusing what Vitter did. I'm saying that essentially that we're talking about sexual misconduct as opposed to public corruption, and I think that the two are different. They're not. I'm not saying I'm a fan of public of sexual misconduct. I'm just saying they're different, and the voters, I think, have the ability to distinguish between the two and say what you do in your private life. I might not like it, but I'm able to distinguish between your ideology, your political ideology, and your ability to do your job from, you know, how you conduct yourself when you're off work.
Well, I noticed in that campaign of 2010, David Vitter did debate Charlie Molossaw once. And he probably could have gotten away without a debate. He was well ahead in the polls. And the question was asked by Greg Merriweather of WAFB, did you commit a crime? And Vitter refused to answer the question. He says, I'm not going to get into stuff that happened 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of those, you know, when did you stop beating your wife kind of questions. I understand it's a very hard question to answer. And Vitter politically, you know, Vitter evaded the question, clearly. Because he probably did commit a crime. Now, you know, he didn't commit I don't think even if he'd been charged with the crime, it would have been a felony. The distinction I'm making is that Edwin Edwards spent 8 years in a federal penitentiary. Mm-hmm. He can't even run for statewide office. He couldn't run for his old office. The Constitution prohibits him from running for his old office because he's still a felon. Unfortunately, the standards to be a member of Congress, Mark Twain might agree with me, that's our only, you know, criminal class. Maybe he is qualified to be in Congress. I don't know. But the standards for running for Congress are lower than the standards for running for statewide office in Louisiana. And so that's why he's running for Congress and not for governor next year. Because I think that if he could run for governor next year, he would do that.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt.
Yeah. And the Democrats, you know, would be in a real quandary there. I mean, they can sort of play around in this race because they know Edwards isn't going to win. They think they can endorse him without consequence because they know he's not going to win this race. And he wouldn't win governor next year, but he would wreak havoc and completely eliminate any chance that a Democrat could win that race next year.
Mm-hmm. Well, just as David Duke could wreak havoc if he could jump in as a Republican candidate next year.
Yeah, right.
And surprisingly, Mr. Duke has not run for office this year because he's like Edwards. He has a federal conviction. He's done his time. He's available for public consumption on the ballot, but he chose not to run. And I understand he's spending a lot of time in Mandeville.
Is that where he is? Yeah, I didn't know that he was even in the state.
He's, I think, moving between Russia and Mandeville.
Interesting.
But he is a man who, let's face it, if he's on any ballot, he starts with 10%.
Yeah, probably so. Mm-hmm. This is a man who got 60% in Duke, a man who got 60% of the white vote in 1990-91. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 10% might be low.
It might be. It might be. 297-5633 for Robert Mann, Manship School of Mass Communication professor, who is now a no-party guy, who has kind words for David Vitter, saying Vitter skillfully channeled Louisiana's growing conservatism. He staked out conservative positions in an increasingly conservative state and made his case more effectively than his Democratic opponent. In short, he earned re-election. And 57% of the people said they were in his camp 2 years ago, 4 years ago. So next year, how does David Vitter do in the governor's election?
Well, I think it remains to be seen, because we don't know who else is going to be running against him. The field is not settled. Public Service Commissioner Scott Angell, former Lieutenant Governor, acting Lieutenant Governor, interim Lieutenant Governor Scott Angell is in the race, which mixes things up a bit. We don't know if John Kennedy, the treasurer, mm-hmm. our state treasurer, Republican state treasurer, will run. We don't know if the mayor of New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu, will run. And there may be others out there who, you know, look, if Mary Landrieu loses,
mm-hmm. you know, she could run,
but
she'll probably become a lobbyist.
Well, you know, my contention is, if Mary Landrieu loses, she needs to come home, set up shop full time in Louisiana, and start running for the Senate in 2016 with Hillary Clinton on the ballot
against David Vitter, and she might do that. That's not a bad idea. But if David Vitter wins the governorship, he will appoint a successor to the Senate seat he holds. His campaign apparatus is behind Bill Cassidy, so Bill Cassidy will be beholden to Senator Vitter. And David Vitter has a ticket of candidates that he is supporting in his governor's race. So he has the capacity to be the most powerful politician in the state since Huey Pierce Long.
He is the most powerful politician in the state since Edwin Edwards, I would say. And I think it's partly not only because Vitter's a good politician on the, you know, publicly. He's not, you know, I mean, let's admit it. Vitter is not the smoothest, most charismatic politician out there. He's a good politician, but he's not an Edwin Edwards. He's not a John Brough. But as far as the behind the scenes stuff, you know, he's very good at cultivating friendships, about cutting deals, about creating alliances. He cares about building a party apparatus in the state and running the party and being involved in ways that Bobby Jindal really never has. And so, you know, Jindal always had his eyes on the White House, never really cared about building the Republican Party in the state. Vitter really cares about that. In fact, Vitter was very much in charge of the Republican Party before his fall in 2007 and lost that, and has steadily built it back into mm-hmm. where I would say that, you know, he's got the inside track on the governor's race next year because of that, because he's got so many amazing alliances that he's built across the state.
He's benefited from good timing in his career. His race in 2010 was 2 years after the election of President Obama, and rather than run against Charlie Mwansaw, he ran against Barack Obama.
Yep.
And we're seeing some of that with Mary Landrieu.
Right.
She is tied to the president, whether she likes it or not, and much of it is related to her vote for Obamacare. Is that the coup de grace?
Obamacare?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't. I looked at a poll this morning, and, you know, Obamacare is just not really moving a lot of people one way or the other. I think the Republicans thought that it would be the compelling issue of this race and the deciding issue of this race, and in state after state after state, it's not. It's become a wash. I think that to the extent that Cassidy and other Republicans are using Obamacare, it's really to rally the party faithful. It's about motivating Republicans, not swinging undecideds. Undecideds are not really in favor of repealing Obamacare. They're more concerned about fixing it. And so it hasn't become the issue. I think it's more Obama himself and his mm-hmm. perceived uncertain leadership that is the problem for Landrieu and other Democrats.
Here's a question from Jason, and it concerns the U.S. Senate as a whole. And Bob has written books about the U.S. Senate, The Walls of Jericho, and others, and including this first about Russell Long.
Yeah, right. Who also became a lobbyist, by the way. I just want to point out.
I know. They almost all do. Jason asked, who will control the Senate after the last election of this year?
Well, we don't know, and there were a lot of. I think the Democrats are still in the tough have the toughest races. I mean, they're defending twice as many Senate seats as the Republicans are. But there are still people like Mary Landrieu and Mark Pryor up in Arkansas and Kay Hagan in North Carolina who should be losing these races by big margins who aren't. They're still within the margin of error, still within striking distance, and so the Republicans need to win. They've got to win these races to win control, and they haven't opened up the decisive leads that you might expect at this point in the race. Now, history shows that when these races start tilting one way or another, they sort of all start tilting one way or the other. So it could be that the Republicans still win the Senate, and I think that's the more likely outcome. But it might not be by some decisive margin. They may all be winning their races by one or two or three points. But just because of the president's unpopularity and the fact that Democrats are defending twice as many seats this year than Republicans are, which is, by the way, will be the opposite in 2006. The Democrats will be defending half as many seats as the Republicans. The Republicans mm-hmm. might win the Senate back in 2014 and lose it in 2016, especially if Hillary Clinton's on the ballot and there's a landslide, which I think is too early to forecast that, but it could change. It could switch hands. It could switch hands by 2016 if the Republicans win it.
Here's a message from Senator Vitter sent via email. Jim, there's a real border crisis in our country, and it's spread into Louisiana schools and communities. We must solve this crisis now, and you can be certain that I'll be fighting to get Harry Reid to act on my legislation to secure the border and prevent amnesty. We must unite and stand up against Obama and Reid to show them that we won't stand for amnesty, and you get a chance to purchase a bumper sticker, secure the border, secure Louisiana. Have you gotten your bumper sticker?
I haven't
sticker,
gotten
Bob?
That yet.
It says donate, and help me get this message out. All we need to do to get this special edition border security bumper sticker is click here and donate $10.
And I think that Vitter has hit on something brilliant, because I think the problem with immigration is we don't have enough bumper stickers. We just don't have enough bumper stickers telling those immigrants to go home. And if we had more of them, perhaps mm-hmm. they would. And then, now they probably need to be in Spanish is the problem. But
well, here was Governor Jindal down on the border of Mexico at the same time, almost fighting against immigration from Mexico, when there was an illegal immigrant causing havoc right here in this community on television, Scott Rogers in open view. Why wasn't he fighting against that illegal immigration?
Well, I don't know. But, you raised something that it's sort of related to what you're saying. I'm not avoiding your question, but I wanted to get this in because I thought that yesterday was pretty instructive about the Jindal's inattention to Louisiana. There's several thousand state workers down there worried about their health care, mm-hmm. and Jindal's up in Washington talking about national defense. The disconnect was jarring.
All right. We'll talk more with Bob Mann, 297-5633, back after 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Bob Mann with us for a few more minutes, and he is following politics, as we all are, 4 weeks before an election. Sunday's New York Times front page magazine story about Louisiana's coast has generated much attention. John Berry, described as the true detective, has been fighting for the preservation of the coast and for a lawsuit against the oil and gas industry. His thanks was that he was fired from the levee board in the New Orleans area by Governor Jindal. Why aren't other politicians, other than Foster Campbell, defending Mr. Berry?
I don't know, and I think that it's tragic that the oil industry has got people so cowed in this state that they're afraid to stand up. Not every politician, by the way. I think it's fair to say there are a lot of people in the legislature who do want to see the oil industry called to account and did not support the legislation that Jindal and his allies, Robert Attlee and others, tried to push to defang that lawsuit. There are people willing to stand up, just not enough of them.
few questions and we'll get to Alan Salkin. If Landrieu is not reelected, writes Jason Falk, and Democrats maintain a majority in the U.S. Senate, who receives her chairmanship of the Energy Committee?
I don't know. I'm not sure who the next person in line on the Energy Committee is, because if the Democrats lose the Senate,
yes.
He's
saying if Landrieu loses and the Democrats
retain. I have no idea who the ranking who the next ranking Democrat is on that committee, but that's an interesting question. It might not be someone from a state so favorably inclined mm-hmm. to energy, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Another question here from Bud about Governor Jindal and his prescription for resolving the Ebola crisis. He's all over this, but Bud writes the governor has been silent about Louisiana having the highest AIDS rate in America.
Well, I mean, he's silent about a lot because he's not here. He's just, you know, he spent his day talking about increasing the defense budget. And by the way, not pointing out how we might pay for it, but increasing the defense budget while state workers are worried about losing their health care. The disconnect is just jarring. He is not paying attention to Louisiana's concerns and hasn't really been for a while. He's letting Christy Nichols, his commissioner of administration, and his staff run the state, and he parachutes in for the occasional announcement of some industrial development project and then goes back on the campaign trail. That's what he's been doing for quite some time now.
And today he's headed for the Citadel to talk about foreign policy.
Right. And, you know, the state is, Rome is burning, and he's fiddling away at the Citadel. It's really a sad situation. We need a full-time governor in this state. We've got a lot of problems in this state that need to be addressed, mm-hmm. and we don't have a governor doing that.
And lastly, a question or a comment actually from Rick. He says Republicans, Democrats, and companies they own would be very short of labor if they were truly called out on the issue of immigration.
Yeah.
Bob Mann, thank you so much.
Thank
Always
you, Jim.
Always a pleasure. Take care. Keep riding. And he's every Sunday in the Picayune and regular with NOLA.com. Alan Salkin is our guest now, a journalist and author, and he has written about various topics, including Annie Leibovitz's financial troubles and other things that are unrelated to his latest work, which has gained much attention. It's called From Scratch, The Uncensored History of the Food Network. Good morning, Alan Salkin.
Howdy, Jim.
Good to hear your voice. Well, the Food Network started same year that Bill Clinton became president, and Clinton has commented that at that time there were fewer than 100 websites in the world, and like the Internet, the Food Network has grown exponentially. How has this process happened?
Well, you know, at that time, there were also only about 30 cable channels, and they knew that the industry knew we were going to go to this 500-channel universe. Obviously, now we're in the gajillion-channel universe with the Internet. But they were just casting about for ideas, and the cable company located in Providence, Rhode Island, then called Colony, which doesn't exist anymore, threw this idea at the wall to try a food network, and they hired a guy named Reese Schonfeld, who was the founding president of CNN, to lead Food Network. Now, Reese was not a food fellow. He and his wife were great New Yorkers. They'd had their kitchen removed to have more space. All they had was a cabinet with dog food and a coffee maker, which is all you really need, right? You know, we have great delivery in New York, which is nice, but... So Reese, it's funny because mentioning the president, they wanted to start Thanksgiving week of 93. Unfortunately, the Monday of that week was November 22nd, 1993, which was obviously the 30th anniversary of the JFK assassination. So they started on that Tuesday. And at that time, I'm not going to tell you the whole history right now in this one answer, but, you know, they started off with Robin Leach, the host of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, had a talk show on the Food Network, then called TVFN, Television Food Network. Donna Hanover Giuliani, the first lady of New York City at that time, incoming Mayor Rudy Giuliani, had a news show on it. And, you know, ultimately, by evolving and surviving and keeping costs low, they eventually hit on something all the way in 1997 with Emeril Live, obviously a guy who started in Fall River, Massachusetts, but made his name in Louisiana. And his show, which was his fourth show, you know, he had had an awful show called How to Boil Water, literally teaching people how to boil water for bachelors. You know, that caught on and Real Live, and that started this new formula of personality and food and entertainment, which is really what carried the Food Network through its peak years.
You say that Rachel Ray almost burned down Emeril Set. How did that
happen? Rachel Ray had a cooking little segment in upstate New York on the news where she would help people, you know, get meals on the table, but eventually they decided to give her a shot on Food Network, and her shtick really was she would go to the refrigerator and make, do all the cooking on camera. The staff of the Food Network, the kitchen staff, was used to creating, you know, roast chickens in six different, you know, layers of roasting so they could swap them out during the show. They had nothing to do. They kept preheating Rachel's skillet. That was the only thing they all focused on. Let's make sure that skillet's hot. So by the time the cameras turned on for her test, she poured olive oil in, EVOO, and boom, you know, a column of flame went up. She thought, I've just burned down Emeril Lagasse's set. They're never having me back. But the show must go on. She pushed the pan aside, put some baking soda in it, and found another pan and went on. And, you know, what's really key about Rachel is her show, 30-Minute Meals, debuted in November 2001, 2 months after 9/11. And that was a period in the country when people were cocooning. They wanted a way back to the simple things in their lives. And Rachel offered a way back into the kitchen, a simple way for a lot of people who couldn't figure out how to make complicated French sauces and other things. And because of her success, that's where you start getting different kind of personalities like Giada De Laurentiis and Ina Garten and Sandra Lee, the First Lady of New York State. I feel like we're on the politics thing because of your previous interview. Uh-huh. But, you know, and this new kind of Food Network personality.
297-5633 in our remaining time with Alan Salkin, author of From Scratch, The Uncensored History of the Food Network, which began in 1993. And talk about rudimentary. You say staffers at the first headquarters of the network, which was located on the far west side of Manhattan, fed themselves leftovers to prostitutes, or they fed prostitutes leftovers who worked out in front of the building. Is that right?
Well, you're missing the fact that most of them at that time, the streetwalkers, were transvestite prostitutes. This was, you know, the Food Network was located in its first headquarters there in a really grungy area of New York. Now, of course, there's high-rises there that cost millions of dollars. But back then, it was just crawling with crime, and the only place to eat nearby was a McDonald's. So that is how it was. And even Julia Child would show up and have to sort of walk through this cloud of street activity to get into the network in those days. It was quite something.
And the marriage between Rudy Giuliani, who you mentioned, and his wife, Donna Hanover, disintegrated. In public view, Donna was quite disconsolate about this.
Yes, and this, you know, this all played out in this great sort of New York news cycle with competing press conferences, and Donna was still doing this daily food news show on Food Network with David Rosengarten called Food News and Views, and then called In Food Today, and she would, you know, be quietly crying in her dressing room over, you know, the divorce and the troubles in her marriage, even before it was publicly announced. People at the Food Network knew this was happening. And it's just such an interesting way that this network touched on so many little interesting pop culture moments in our history that, you know, to look at the last 20 years through this prism, you know, everything from 9/11 to this, the politics to, you know, the way that, mm-hmm. that food has become such an interesting and important local, you know, area of interest. It's all, you know, around the Food Network is this important pop culture force.
You have some amazing anecdotes that are detailed in From Scratch, including one involving a hedge fund billionaire. What happened with the hedge fund?
Well, Steve Cohen of SAC, who recently has, you know, been under investigation, he was a big fan of Guy Fieri of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. And so, you know, a lot of people who love Guy, many people hate him, fantasize about getting in that Camaro and driving around with Guy and going to, you know, diners. And this guy is so rich, he could pay Guy's day rate, which is $100,000, if you want Guy to, you know, show up at your food festival or hang out with you. And so there it was, $100,000, and he got to drive around Guy Fieri for the day. And he, in fact, even got his favorite hot dog joint on the television show.
And Alan, you're right that an internal scandal erupted after a marketing person approved an ad campaign for Naked Chef. What happened?
Well, Jamie Oliver's show, Naked Chef, they created this. You know, there was always this tension between the crazy people in New York and the more conservative types in Knoxville, Tennessee, who are the corporate owners. And the advertising guys in New York came up with this idea to show extreme close-ups of peaches and cantaloupes that, if, when looked at from a certain angle in a certain way, might look like rear ends and other body parts. And so the corporate bigwigs were so horrified that they, you know, called and demanded the whole thing be yanked, and it was a, you know, expensive ad buy in USA Today that was pulled. You know, it's known as the, you know, the fruit incident.
Some telling quotes. Martha Stewart once said, "I don't want this shown. I want the tapes of this whole series destroyed."
Barefoot Contessa, Ina Garten, still one of the most popular people on Food Network, was so bad. You know, Martha Stewart, her company was going to produce a show called In the Kitchen with Ina. And Ina Garten was so bad, you know, she cut herself badly, and it's a whole story I tell in the book, that when Martha saw the results of these pilot tapes, she ordered them all destroyed. And it wasn't until a year later, and, you know, also Martha Stewart didn't like the fact that Ina was using some of the same tableware that that Martha was using. She may, it turns out she maybe didn't want another female star under her umbrella. But it wasn't until a year later that they tried again without Martha Stewart that we get the Barefoot Contessa that everybody loves.
And Paula Deen, who's had her problems, she pushed through her agent relentlessly to get a slot on the Food Network. It wasn't an easy process.
That's right. You know, she actually, speaking of Martha Stewart, you know, Paula Deen wanted to be the Martha Stewart of the South. That was her goal. And it was funny. It wasn't until 9/11 that her agent, Barry Weiner, a really sharp guy, convinced the Food Network to give her a shot. For years, the Food Network executives had said, well, people don't want that kind of greasy, southern, lowbrow food that she's making, and, you know, this is for chefs. And, you know, it wasn't until 9/11 that the agent told the president of Food Network, well, on your way home from work, why don't you stop by the Carnegie Deli, which is in New York, and they serve sandwich, pastrami and corned beef sandwiches that are about a foot high. And after 9/11, people wanted comfort, and so they were lined up for these sandwiches, and they weren't lined up at the expensive restaurants. And so at that point, Food Network decided, well, maybe a show about greasy fried chicken is a good idea.
Well, it's quite a ride from scratch, the uncensored history of the Food Network from Alan Salkin, who was a former rubber ducky salesman.
Well, you know, I dedicated the book to my father, who passed away the day I handed it in, and he had a rubber ducky company, and so I worked with him, and yeah, I sold many rubber duckies. Many children in America and others are, you know, still using those rubber duckies.
Well, we certainly have an affinity for food in this country, and the Food Network has been able to capitalize on that beautifully.
Yeah, you know, and when you look at the story over the last 20 years, you know, this country was not, there were a lot of food deserts, you know, places like New Orleans, the San Francisco Bay Area, Chicago, New York. There was some really food forward thinking in the 80s and early 90s. And it wasn't until Food Network comes along and sort of takes this sort of obscure artistic knowledge and, you know, spreads the gospel to the masses that what we have now, you know, where you can get a salad at McDonald's takes place.
Well, Alan, we thank you for joining us. Congrats on another fine work, and you have a varied career as a young man.
Yeah,
you've written about more kinds of things than anybody of your vintage I know of. So, keep it going.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Alan Salkin. From Scratch: The Uncensored History of the Food Network. Tomorrow on this show, we're slated to hear among others from Elbert Gillery, the state senator from Opelousas, who, of course, has become a Republican, a black Republican, who quite likely will be running for lieutenant governor and has gotten a lot of mileage out of some internet missives. His YouTube announcement that he was a Republican has well over a million viewers. By the way, Bobby Jindal has never gotten more than a few thousand viewers for any of his YouTube entries. And now Elbert Gillery has another one attacking Senator Mary Landrieu. So I'm sure many people will be engaged on either side when Elbert Gillery shows up tomorrow. And the election, as noted, is 4 weeks away. So no matter what your political stripes, we hope you vote. LSU football, 0-2 in the SEC for the first time in the Les Miles era. And the Tigers, coming off their worst loss in the 21st century, have been installed, perhaps surprisingly, as two-point favorites in Saturday's game at Gainesville against Florida, where Miles has won only one time in four previous visits. We'll talk about this and other things as we move along this week. For Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.